in Victoria with a pastor friend of mine. He's a little bit older than me. He's retired, and he said, Tom, are you retired now? And I said, no, I'm not retired. I'm still working. He said, oh, where are you working? I said, I'm working at a Chinese church in Vancouver. He said, you're not Chinese. Do you know that? I said, yeah, I kind of knew that. So we talked a little bit about that, and he said, why do you go over there every week? It didn't take a lot of traveling and time. And I thought about it for a moment, and I was thinking about it as I stand down here at the front row, just as Willis was leading in worship this morning. And I want to tell you what I told him very sincerely, and sitting in Tim Hortons in Victoria last week. I said, I really have come to love the people. I said, I've really come to love the church. And I feel loved back by them. I said, I enjoy the staff. We have just fun together, Pastor Johnny and Cindy, and as they prayed for me this morning again. And I said, they're receptive to God's word. And I said, yeah, it takes some traveling. But you know what? I just have come to love the people there. I love the board and working with them, and the moderator and the people on the staff and so on. So I was thinking about that this morning, just standing there. I want you to know that. So I shared this morning in Victoria one day last week. So thank you for all that you, if I bring something to you, can I just tell you very seriously that you bring and give so much more to me. And I thank you for that. We live in the most technologically advanced time in history. I'm sure you know that. I was thinking in this past several weeks, my grandparents are both passed away now as they grew up in Scotland. My grandparents never owned a car. They never flew in a plane. They never had a telephone, and I don't mean a cell phone. I mean one of those big black phones that, you know, you dial like that. Never had any of that. My parents never owned a checkbook. They paid cash for everything as they went. Never owned a checkbook. Never had a credit card. Some years ago, my mother, when she was out in Canada, she's passed away also, but she was out, and we went out for coffee and a muffin somewhere, and I don't never carry a lot of money with me, I'll just tell you that. So I took out my Interact card, and we bought a couple of coffees and a muffin, and I swiped my Interact card, and she said to me, Tom, I don't like you using credit for things like this. I hope you pay that off. So I said, well, Mom, this actually isn't really a credit card. This is called an Interact card. So when I swipe that, the bank instantly takes the money right off my bank account. She says, I know, but I don't like you using a credit card like that. So I said, okay, and that's fine. Recently, I was putting some new film in my 35mm camera at home, and one of my grandchildren was watching me, and they said to me, what's that? And I said, that's film. And so he said to me, what's film? But this is the same kid who a few months ago said, Grandpa, let's go to Starbucks. And so I said, okay. He says, I'll pay. He's 9 at that time. So I said, have you got money? He said, no, but I got a Starbucks card. And I thought to myself, I'm 67, and I don't have a Starbucks card. My grandchildren are going to Starbucks. We live in a changing world, you know that. So when you read this morning a commandment from 3,500 years ago about staying away from idols and the errors of idolatry, frankly, that seems irrelevant and impractical. That does not relate to the world, it would seem, in which we live. Because we're not worshiping little statues of idols, or are we? May I remind you, the Ten Commandments we started into last week are not slogans for self-improvement. They're not a spiritual aerobics program to win God's approval. It's not a mandate for social reconstruction. It's none of these kinds of things. It really is, as we said, it's the transcript of the holiness of God. How do we live as God's people in the time in which we live? And yet, even as we understand that this second word this morning in the Decalogue about not worshiping idols may seem so out of place for us. In about 30 minutes, I hope I convince you that it's not. We need to get practical and down to earth this morning. Let me begin with a story. The story's in the Bible. If you don't know it, you can turn in your Bible or your iPad or whatever you use to Exodus chapter 32. And I'm just going to summarize because it's about 24 verses. It's a little too long to read this morning. That's unfortunate. But let me just summarize the story for you. It happened a little time after the Israelites have received these commandments from God. So God's given them the 10 words, what I call last Sunday, the facts of life talk. They should have been fresh in their minds. Now Moses goes back up to the mountain to meet with God, and the people become a little confused and they assume that they're never going to see him again. He's gone and he ain't coming back. And so they appeal to Aaron and they say to Aaron, Aaron, you got to do something. So Aaron tells them to take off their jewelry and they melt it down and they would fashion this into an idol. Because they've been used to doing things like that. And the idol is in the shape of what? A calf, a golden calf. The people worship it. They dance around it. They put it in the center of their lives. They watch the glow of the flames. They see themselves in the reflection and it almost mesmerizes them. And then, lo and behold, Moses comes back down the mountain. And he's furious. He's mad. He asks, what's going on? And Aaron's got one of the greatest excuses in the Bible. He says, we threw the gold into the fire and out jumped this calf. Well, whatever. The story goes on to tell them that God and Moses is furious with them. He makes them grind the tablets of stone into powder, and they put it in water. The people are made to drink it. That's a story for another time. You just can't imagine today people sitting around some inanimate object, stirring with excitement and fascination at it as they did in that time. April 10th, 1939, the World's Fair in New York City, a new invention made its debut, and it was met with skepticism. The problem, they said, is that people are simply being asked to sit and watch. And the New York Times wrote, the American people will not go for this invention. It will not go anywhere. It's a waste of time. That new invention was called television. Television. So what do we worship today? What are some of the things we worship today? Well, I think we've become worshippers of our inventions. We worship what we've created. We worship our technology. I was in Oak Ridge Mall a week past Friday. And I saw this huge, huge lineup of people. I saw the Apple Store. And I thought, what is it? What are they doing? It was the day that they released what? iPhone 5, lined up to get their new invention. We worship at the temple of the celebrity. And we've made idols out of famous people. You know, it seems that charisma has become more important to us than character. A whole industry, television programs are built around what the stars are doing and wearing and marrying and divorcing and whatever else. Our society no longer has heroes. We only have stars. We've become worshippers of sports. If you're a sports nut, please just forgive me for the next few minutes. We've become worshippers of sports. If you notice, there's no hockey on right now. What is that? The guys are on strike for more money or whatever it is. I wish I'd brought it. There was a letter to the editor yesterday in the Times Colonist in Victoria. Just furious about the hockey being off. And the man was writing, this is our national game. This is our identity. This is our passion. And he's pleading in the letter that Stephen Harper ought to get organized and get Parliament organized to mandate the hockey players and the NHL people back to the bargaining table and fix it. Because we need this in Canada. Now, I'm not real up on hockey, but Willis told me, where's Willis? Willis told me, how many teams are Canadian? 7. Out of how many? 30, okay. So that's what Stephen Harper's supposed to do. We've become worshippers at a little white ball. And some people would sell their souls to get it into the hole in the middle of this pretty little green. I think to myself, if it's that hard, you know what? Just make the hole bigger. My voice, Okay, we've become worshippers of beauty and health. That's a billion-dollar industry. We are modern-day followers of a man who is called Narcissus. This young man who fell in love with himself and his reflection in a pool. We have become worshippers of self. You get my point. Worshippers is not about having little statues in some corner in our home. It is about the condition of our heart before this one and only true God. Great songs this morning for us to lead in worship. So what is idolatry? Let me give you some ideas. You've got some notes that will just give you the headings. Idolatry is about an exchange. It's about exchanging God for something that's not God. It's taking God out of the center of life and exchanging and putting something else into the center of life or someone else. One of the things, by the way, I think we've worshipped certainly in North America in this whole exchange is creation. We've taken the Creator out and we've put creation in. Here's Romans. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power, His divine nature have been clearly seen. For although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him, but their thinking became futile, their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. And here's the point. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. And so, idolatry, you see, is an exchange in terms of creation. We are called to be stewards of creation. This is not just our larder to get food. It is not just our sports arena in which we play. Creation is the landscape on which God painted the world. It's the divine canvas that God has painted for us. But when we put creation in the place of the Creator, and we worship creation, we give creation a rank of deity. And it means we diminish and we reduce God, as we'll see later. So idolatry is about an exchange, making something holy which is not holy, and taking something which is holy and treating it as ordinary. Idolatry is also about exalting something that is not God and making it God, lifting it up to the place of being God when it's really not. When we do that, we lower God. We make Him second place. Idolatry is also about empowering something that is really dead, and believing that if we can sort of breathe into it enough, then we really can give it life. And then its fictitious rules over us. In the meantime, we take the things that really have the breath of God in them, and we remove the breath of God and treat them as though they were dead. So you see, idolatry is the many different ways in which we diminish God. We make Him lesser than He is, and we shrink His position. We take something that's peripheral, and we make it central. We take what's dead, we try to make it come to life. We can be idolatrous about anything. For example, we can be idolatrous about a style of worship. We can say, you know, Anglicans, we have an Anglican style of worship. We might say, we have a Baptist style of worship. We can be an idolatrous about any issue and hold it sacred. We can be idol worshippers of anything. So perhaps we are more alike the children of Israel than we know, dancing around a golden calf. And we have committed idolatry in our technological culture. Our culture has altered the external face of idolatry, and we've moved it from something material to something which is mental. It's moved from being external to being internal. And the force of idolatry gives power to something in our imagination. It's the mind and power of the imagination that gives idolatry its force. The book of Isaiah asks us, to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with Him? As for the idol, a craftsman, a goldsmith plates it with gold, a silversmith fashions it with chains of silver. To whom will you liken God? That beautiful song we began with this morning says He is beautiful beyond description, too marvelous for words. Idolatry distorts our understanding of God, and so it misleads people. The misdirection comes from the fact it begins from a human point of origin rather than a godly point of origin. Our image of God is created then in our imagination and is limited by our imagination. The God who is made by our minds is too small, he's too localized, he's a person-sized God. A God who is made in our image is one that we will try to control. And so you see, to think wrongly about God, in essence, is to think wrongly about everything. To think rightly about God, right at the very beginning, is the most important step in thinking rightly about everything else. At the heart of each commandment is God's nature. So here's what Deuteronomy says about this God. Be careful not to forget the covenant the Lord your God made with you, and do not make for yourselves an idol in the form of anything the Lord your God has forbidden. For it says in the next verse, for the Lord your God is a consuming fire. He is a jealous God. Now, most of the time when we use the word jealous in English, I don't know what you do in Chinese, but when you use it in English, we're usually using it in a negative way. Being jealous means that we hold on to something, and we don't want to share it with anybody else. Having a jealous nature is usually regarded as a negative trait or a negative quality. Usually that's what it means. But this morning I'd like to remind you that the word jealous actually is a neutral word. It can be both positive and also negative. We usually use it in the negative sense, but the word jealous also can have a positive side. We can say that we love our children so much that we jealously guard them and we guard their safety. We do anything to protect them. We're jealous for them, so we want the very best for them. We can say that we jealously love our spouse, which means we will not allow anything or anyone to interfere with our relationship and to come between us. Why? Because we're jealous of it. Not negative, that's positive. We want to hold it tightly and hold it to ourselves. And so positive jealousy is protective. It shields, it defends, it holds us close to its heart. We need to realize that. Jealous love does not give equal time to other contenders. Jealous love is not about equal opportunity. Jealous love does not give room to rivals. Jealous love does not accept competition. Jealous love will not accept second place. Jealous love says, I want to be first. In one place, the Apostle Paul writes about the church. He says, I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. Now that's the kind of love that God has for His people, for us as His redeemed nation. And it's crucial that we understand what this jealous heartbeat of God is toward us. Because that is the heart and the core of this commandment. Jealous love runs hot because this holy God has a divine passion for us. And the more we become aware of this divine envy for our lives and allow this jealous love of God to touch our lives, to sear our soul, to burn its way into our heart, the more we will be changed. God's jealous love was costly for Him. It sent us under the cross. The Father let go the one person who had shared His essence, who shared the glory of heaven. It cost the Father the presence of His Son. This divine jealousy, this godly envy for us, meant that the Father somehow felt the pain of sin in this divine exchange. There were so many lines of thought in my mind this week. I had to distill it down to one basic question. Here's the question I'd like us to think about for a few minutes this morning. Am I willing to identify and remove anything in my life that prevents me from being touched, changed by this divine jealousy? Am I willing to identify anything in my life that this jealous love of God has to stumble over to get to me? Divine jealousy is not prepared to settle for the simple rearrangement of the furniture in our lives, nor the reorganization of the pieces of our time. Divine jealousy asks and demands nothing less than the renovation of our lives, and for most of us, this might be more costly and more upsetting than we realize. To get there this morning, let me take you to a story you may not know. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 7. This is not an easy story to read. And it's not an easy story in the culture in which we live, and one against which we can have all kinds of struggles and objections. But it's in the text of the scripture. Deuteronomy chapter 7, if you can find it or know where it is. This is when, after 40 years, Israel is now come again to this question about moving into the new land. And God is saying to them, let's try it again. Let's see if we can get it right this time. And let's move ahead. And as you move ahead, cross over into the land, here is something you need to do. Deuteronomy 7:1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you're entering to possess and drives out before you the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them. Show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons, nor take your daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, kind of their holy places. Smash the sacred stones. Cut down their Asherah poles. Asherah poles were probably poles that were fashioned and figured in a very grotesque, sexual kind of a way. Burn their idols in the fire. I mean, you have to wipe out the land. You have to destroy them. For, verse 6, you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all of the peoples on the face of the earth to be his treasure, his treasured possession. For the Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than all the other peoples, but because you were the fewest of the peoples. Remember, he's a jealous God. Jealous for this love from his people. And so Israel is told in a very difficult passage to clear the land. The people are instructed to clear out the symbols of polytheistic religion, to destroy the false deities that were often crude and sexual, to take away the potential and the opportunity of intermarriage because of this divine jealousy. There's to be a new landscape established as they worship the one and only true God. Clear the land, take everything else out, so the land is open and clear before you. I thought of it again this morning, just standing here, just as a little aside. I can't go too far down it for time this morning. But there was a group of people. The word went out what the Israelites were doing, by the way. And a group of people called the Gibeonites came to them. Now, the Gibeonites played a trick on them. The Gibeonites came with old clothes. The shoes on their feet were all worn. They came with water bottles all dry and dusty. And the Gibeonites said to the Israelites, "We know what you're doing. We would prefer if this didn't happen to us. But you know what, guys? We come from so far away. I mean, look at our shoes and our water bottles and whatever. We will not be any trouble to you. So just kind of leave us alone. Okay? We come from far away. We're small. Don't worry about us. We won't get in the road." Interesting story is that the Israelites then let the Gibeonites go. They fell for their trick. And if you follow on in the book of Joshua, the Gibeonites become a problem for the Israelites. Why? Because they didn't clear them out of the land at that time. Okay? Just there. Now, what's this passage saying to us? It is not telling us to go out and rent bulldozers and destroy the neighborhood around Vancouver to create a nice Christian neighborhood that we can write Bible verses on the walls instead of graffiti. Rather, it's saying we need to clear the landscape, and you've got to get this morning, we need to clear the landscape in our minds and in our hearts. It's the landscape within us that needs clearing. Gerald Manley Hopkins, a British poet, called this inscape. Inscape is the landscape inside us. It is the eternal landscape in our hearts and in our minds. It is what we think about, what we dream about. It is the landscape of our heart that needs to be cleaned and made choices. It's exactly what Jesus teaches us. Mark chapter 7. For within, out of men's and women's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these things, says Jesus, come from inside. Now that's inscape. The stuff within us. You see, authentic Christianity is not about improving our values, reshuffling our priorities, realigning goals. These are cosmetic changes. This divine jealousy calls for a renovation of the heart. That will demand of us that we clear the landscape of our minds, which is where we have built ideas with material stronger than concrete. It's where we have the basement of our souls that we don't want anyone else to see, because the basement of our souls is often full of garbage. The real environmental cleanup for us is toxic. It's on the inside. The toxic waste dump of our world is in our hearts and in our minds. And that's where God is saying to us and to His people, you need to clear the land. Here's a dimension of clearing the land you may not think about. It is not only clearing the land that we may have filled with moral rubble. It means that we clear the land before we even move into it. Have you ever thought that clearing the land involves identifying and removing the obstacles that are a potential threat to our lives? And that means that a clearly cultivated heart and life will be able to foresee and forestall situations even before they come. There are problems and difficulties that should not come to Christians. Not because we're better than anybody, but because we have cleared the land before we get there. We anticipate problems. We understand the rules of the Gibeonites. And we clear them out of the way before we come, before we get to those kinds of places. We should have the insight to see the potential of evil before we get there, and do not fall unsuspecting into its trap. When we clear this inner landscape and remove potential obstacles, you know what? We keep our lives free for God and ourselves and the days of the head. One of the many realities of life for all kinds of people is a mortgage. You know what that is? I've often thought M-O-R-T is the root of the French word to kill. It means it's going to kill you every month, I think that's what it means. Do you understand that when we sign a mortgage, we are committing the future? When we sign a mortgage, we're tying up money for the next 25 years. For many of us, we don't have any other choice. I understand that. But more expensive than the mortgage in our house is when a young person, perhaps in a thoughtless decision, mortgages their future, ties up their future, maybe physically, emotionally, spiritually, sexually, whatever it is. The greatest gift of freedom we can give God and ourselves is to clear the land out of our lives and to keep our lives free from junk. Again, I thought this week of a sensitive situation I was faced with some years ago. A young couple came to me. They just got engaged. They were planning to get married, which was nice and exciting. And somewhere in their, as their conversation became closer about things ahead of them, they realized in the relationship that the young woman had kept her virginity. This was her gift to give to her lover on a wedding night. And in the conversation, the young man confessed that he had not. And now they were devastated. She did not know if she wanted to move ahead with this relationship. And he felt terrible for what he'd done, because now he'd met the one woman with whom he wanted to spend all of his life. And we talked about that. And if that's the situation you've been in, I'm not trying to beat you up. But we talked about that. We prayed together. They cried. He cried. She cried. We all cried. And they were able to put the relationship on a new beginning and move ahead. They're married today. They've got little kids. Great. I wrote them a card later. And I said to them, you need to understand, we sung this morning, by the way, and about the forgiveness of God. And it just, they needed to know that. I wrote them a card and said, in His forgiveness, God does not restore virginity, but He does restore purity. That was important to them. The greatest gift we can give God and ourselves is to keep our lives free for Him. Now that kind of work, I'll tell you, is not easy. We may avoid it more than we know. It may create conflict and struggle within us. Yet it's the most important work we can do. This divine jealousy asks us to have the holy courage to clear the land within us where we have walked and even where we have not walked, so that we will walk in the land of our lives as God's holy people. God is a jealous lover. His love for us runs hot, so hot that he's not willing to coexist with any other gods or any idol. God will not tolerate competition. He is not willing to accept anything else that competes with his love for us. He is not willing to accept any rivals in our relationships. Let me give you an idea. It's a really dangerous idea if you think about it. God is so unwilling to be second in my life and yours that if he cannot be the first and the only, he may withdraw from us and leave us alone to live out our decisions, to accept the consequences of our actions. Remember what we sow, we reap. God is simply unwilling to negotiate a second place position in us. So if he says to us, I want to be first and only in our lives, he says, God, I've got some other things going on in my life, but I'm happy to put you down the ladder one step, one rung. Let me suggest to you God's answer to that might well be no. No. Where does that come from? I take that idea from the story of whom we call the rich young ruler who asked Jesus, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life? Jesus tells him about the commandments. He says, I've done those since I'm a boy. Jesus says, you sell everything you have and you come and follow me. And it says he went away sad. What was at stake for him had eternal significance. That's not a question about lifestyle or values. It is a question about life. It's a question about the jealous love of God. Apparently the cost of renovating his life and clearing the landscape of his heart was too much. But there was no negotiation, no arbitration, no compromise, no concession. Think about it. God is so unwilling to be second in our lives that if he cannot be the first and only, he may be willing to leave us alone with our decision. He is simply unwilling to negotiate to be second. Because he's jealous. If he cannot be first, he's prepared to wait until we come to that place in our lives, perhaps through crisis or whatever, where we are ready to invite him to be the first. He will wait until we have dealt with the idols we have set up in our lives. He will wait until we clear the land within us. Let me ask you that question again. Am I willing to identify and tear down anything in my life, even some of the good stuff, that prevents me from being touched and changed and loved by the jealous love of God? What have I made into an idol, exchanging the glory of God to worship something else? We can exchange it back and put God in the rightful place. What have I exalted in my life beyond its importance and measure and made it like God? We can take whatever it is off the pedestal and put God back on the top. What have I breathed life into to give it life when God alone is our breath and is our life giver? As we sing in a moment, we can fill our lungs afresh with the breath of God. Can you imagine what our lives would be like if we cleared the rubble and the mess within us, that inscape, and felt the divine passion, this jealous love of God, flow for us, flow toward us, and flow in us, and know that it was the one thing above everything else that was driving us. Because he's a jealous God. Doesn't mean he's angry with us. It means he loves us more than anything else.